Hey, hey, hey. We are back with another episode of Scholar Tea. Hopefully you liked the jump off of season four. Isn't that crazy? With our wonderful Ash live recording. Hopefully your heart was warm. Your tear ducts were watered. Your life was changed. I love Black Ashe. It was in Minneapolis, but it was a good conference. I really enjoyed that. It was one of my favorite conferences in a recent memory. So I love a good Black Ashe. So here we are back with another jump off of Scholar Tea. And our temperature check for today is, if you were a Super Bowl halftime performer, what is your mood on today?
My mood on today is Rihanna with Child. Like, I'm all right. You know, my outfits actually have been nice. You know, the people around me doing what they need to do. And I'm gonna give you just enough. And you know what? It's like, I have nothing to prove right now.
Nothing
I'm doing
to prove.
Good work, and I'm going to use my products in this lineup to get the work done, and you're going to get just enough from me. Yes.
But my thing is, like, our just enough is the other people's, right?
Yes. You know what, Tamara? She did have to coach me about that just the other day. She's like, Shauna, I think we are so used to overperforming that just kind of giving them not even the baseline, but like average work. You feel guilty about offering average work because you're so used to overperforming, and you need to give yourself some grace and the reward of time and mental space, because that is exhausting and it is not sustainable.
Not sustainable.
So I'm Rihanna with Child, but I'm not with Child. Let's be clear.
You are with Child. Okay. His name is Kingsley, okay? Well, my mood on today is a good Janet Jackson, Papa Titty Out, live TV. That's what I've been feeling lately. Kind of like young and free, so to speak. Like, I'm ready to go do some, you know, boom, 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 boom music in my underwear. You know what I'm saying? On a beach. I'm just really ready to live life. And I think it's stepping into 40. It's like, you get one life. You probably didn't live half of it. So fuck the bullshit. And let's live the rest of it the way that we want to live it. So that's been my mood here lately. It's also foreshadowing my sabbatical, because I'm ready to... It's just the emails, the meetings, the time that people want. And I'm just like, when can I just not be responding to something or sitting in a meeting like WTF? I'm ready for a break, which I know I sit in a place of privilege as a faculty member that gets to take a year-long sabbatical that my administrator friends like yourself don't necessarily get. But it's a benefit, and I'm going to take advantage of it.
And I think there's something to be said about using your capacity at 120 at all times, because you're thinking about your work when you go to sleep, probably dreaming about it and not remembering it. You wake up to it. That's a whole nother kind of exhaustion that people aren't really talking about.
Absolutely. So Shauna, on this episode of Scholar Tea, we are going to do what we usually do, and we are going to highlight our scholar of the week. We are going to spill some tea, but also lift up and dedicate this episode to Black women administrators in higher education and protecting them at all costs. We have a wonderful interview with the Dr. LaWanda Ward. We have some what's problematic, a question of the week, some jokes of the week, and we have some affirmations and some shout outs. So let's get into it, Shauna. Our scholar of the week this week is Dr. Raquel Rall. Dr. Rall is an associate professor in the School of Education at UC Riverside. And before that, she was a UC Chancellor's postdoctoral fellow and assistant research professor at the University of Southern California. She has a PhD in urban education policy from USC and degrees in human biology and African-American and African diaspora studies from Stanford University. Her research centers post-secondary leadership and governance. A particular interest for Dr. Rall is research that helps further illuminate the centrality of concepts like equity, diversity, and inclusion to post-secondary decision-making. With her research, teaching, and service, Dr. Rall centers equity-mindedness to push issues of leadership and decision-making from the periphery to the core to better understand how the decisions and decision-makers impact outcomes within higher education. If there was ever a time to research that. At UC Riverside, she teaches courses like critical issues in higher education governance, Black Brilliance Matters in Organization and Administration. First of all, I want to take break. Let me see that syllabus. Black Brilliance Matters. At the system level, she serves on the UC Black Administrators Council and is inaugural convener for the UC Online Advisory Council. She is the first Black woman to be tenured in and is the first Black faculty chair of the School of Education. Shout out to Dr. Rawl and the change that she is making.
We do appreciate you, Dr. Rawl, and everything that you contribute to the field. We depend on people like you and your scholarship.
She's also fun and hilarious. And, you know, those are my favorite people. The people that do the work, but can also, you can sit at the bar and have a kiki. Like, to me, it humanizes the work that we do every day. So shout out to Dr. Rawl. Can't wait to have a drink with you.
Well, I love a good kiki. And also, like, I just appreciate people that are willing to embody the fullness of our different communities in a way that's actually holistic and well-rounded. We're not just research material. So today we're actually going to speak to a very intimate point of conversation that's been rippling through our communities for the past year, I think, at this point, in a hyper elevated way. We've understood this issue to be of concern for quite some time, but it feels like it's been magnified more recently around some very public situations involving Black women and thinking about what it means to protect Black women at all costs in higher education. And we're speaking to the unexpected deaths of Black women university presidents, for example, like Joanne A.E. Epps of Temple University, or Dr. Orinthia T. Montague of Volunteer State Community College. Both of those deaths sent shockwaves throughout higher education. And while the causes of death for both leaders have yet to be revealed, understandably so, many people speculate that stress led to their untimely passing. But then you also think about how the institutions responded or failed to respond in moments of tragedy for these folks. Like, for example, at Temple University, they continued with the memorial service while we're recognizing that Dr. Epps is under duress and is later passing away from her experiences in this world. The past few weeks have also been full of controversy related to the tragedy touching the lives of Black women in academia. For instance, Dr. Claudine Gay, who was the first Black woman to lead Harvard University, stepped down after a donor-led campaign pushed for her ouster over plagiarism accusations and her response to anti-Semitism on campus. So she's the first Black woman to lead Harvard University and also the shortest term president in the history of Harvard. And then earlier this year, a former administrator at Lincoln University, a historically Black college, died by suicide. Dr. Bonnie Candia Bailey, the former vice president of student affairs, reportedly complained of bullying at the institution. And the school's president, a white man, has taken a leave of absence as a result of the case being reviewed. But all of this led to an outcry over the treatment of Black women in higher education, something that has actually been a point of conversation, reflection, and research for decades. And so we're at a turning point, I think. We're trying to determine, like, at what point will, at the systemic level, we experience change, because this place is literally killing us.
Yeah, we think about Black women and we think about the exploitation of their, not only their bodies, but their brilliance in spaces of higher education. That exploitation has been decades, as we know. You and I have friends and colleagues, but the high publicity deaths that have been shined these past few weeks, I think, has been a reckoning, but I almost feel like it's been an insular community reckoning and not necessarily a broader higher education reckoning in terms of what are we doing to support Black women administrators at the most senior level, right? But at the mid-level and the director level, I think is where this conversation might need to start, because those are the people that become the senior leaders, whether in the academic side or on the student affairs side. And how do we think about having a conversation that can start insular, but has strategy that's broader for higher education, specifically thinking about people in president's cabinet, board of trustees, or other people that want to hire Black women, that do hire Black women, that tokenize Black women, but then don't want to take responsibility when they harm Black women.
The interesting thing to your point that I think about is Patricia Hill Collins, when she talks about the insider within and how Black women in institutions of higher education are allowed to be represented, but they are not of the community, and the ways that this society has framed Black women or Black womanhood as caretaker. I think the other thing that's compounding the stress beyond the obvious implications of social location is the ways that these institutions treat us like we're cleanup women, right? Like we are caretakers to clean up someone else's mess, a mess that was probably years or decades in the making. They expect us to do it within a year's time with no support, no budget. And then we're usually the lowest paid amongst our peers. So in addition to thinking about what it means to be an entry-level, mid-level professional, an executive member of some of these cabinets, one thing I know that resoundingly becomes clear to me is the fact that regardless of the positionality within the institution, a lot of my contemporaries have been utilized as a tool of necessity for caretaking instead of really recognizing the value, the worth, the expertise that comes with our years of training, with our other ways of knowing and understanding that we are more than the maid or the help.
I also think about the most, and I'm not a Black woman, but I think about the most isolating experiences that women are having, specifically though, I was going to say specifically those historically white spaces. But I think about what happened at Lincoln University, and I don't know all of the ins and outs, but it has to be an isolating feeling, even being a Black woman with other Black faces. Now, they had a white president. That's a whole nother conversation. But I see my Black women colleagues. I had a dear friend who was a VPSA at a small private HBCU. And she talked about it being the most draining experience that she's ever had. And there were other Black women that looked like her, but there were the other Black men there. But she talked about being the face of decision-making. And when you become the face of decision-making, you also become the place where people can swing their bat and take out their frustrations, and you get worn out from those particular experiences. Also think about Black women in academic affairs units, who are the only or the first, right? Raquel, it's 2024 and Raquel is the first tenured, right? At a UC school, right? And we're still having first or only. And I think about my own department, right? Tamara has been here for, you know, years and sometimes been the only across the college, right? She's been a support system to me and a mentor. The isolating feeling of what that is and what that feels like, it drains you physically and emotionally and the mental health. And we haven't had that conversation when thinking about that. Yeah, we can support one another. Yeah, we can go to conferences. Yeah, we have Sisters of the Academy. But that doesn't remove the realities of the context that people are doing this work in.
And I think it's great that theoretically people understand the nexus of intersectionality and thinking about how race comes together with power, privilege, and patriarchy and informs then how our bodies must maneuver power and privilege within these systems. But when you think about the fact that even Elmira Mangum was the first Black woman president of FAMU, and she only made it 3 years and they ousted her 10 to one, like this was in a historically Black framework. This was in a historically Black institution, and still the tendrils of patriarchy still impacted her daily experience there. And usually when you look at the trajectory of college presidents, yes, 4 to 5 years, but the research is indicating that Black women who become presidents, it's 2 to 3. So there's something happening at a very systematized level that is, again, impacting the lived experience of Black women in a manner that is harmful. It's detrimental to our mental health, our physical health, our overall well-being in a disproportionate way. I think it would behoove us as educators, as leaders, to truly pay attention to what this is meaning for the academy, because it is playing out not just in the lived experiences of administrators, faculty, staff, but then conversely, this is also the experiences of our students.
Absolutely. Shameless plug, I have a paper with Dr. Nadrea Njoku and Dr. Malika Butler titled Reimagining, you know, HBCU Environment, Exposing Race Secrets and the Binding Chains of Respectability and Other Mothering. And it frames it in HBCU context, but I think it can apply to higher education more broadly. So take a look at that article, because we really call out the real implications of respectability politics, but the other mothering, to your point, and that labor that Black women have been asked to do with the cleanup. So
put the link in the bio.
Please read the episode notes. I'll be sure to put the article link in the episode note. In terms of what's next, I do for us want to hold space for those Black women who are no longer with us and they gave and sacrificed. So I do want to hold space for those women and for those that are living and currently feeling like they're alone. I want to hold space for them. All right. So next up, we have our wonderful interview with Dr. LaWanda Ward.
Dr. LaWanda Ward serves as Associate Professor of Education and Associate Director for the Center for the Study of Higher Education at Penn State University. Dr. LaWanda Ward's commitment to social justice, equity, and inclusion in higher education is influenced by her family of educators. Her mother, a first grade teacher for almost 30 years, marched during the Civil Rights Movement. Dr. Ward's research agenda critically analyzes higher education legal issues, including race-conscious admissions, free speech, and academic freedom. Welcome, Dr. Ward. Today, we are blessed to spend time with Dr. LaWanda Ward, a woman full of passion, vigor, and love. Dr. Ward, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and talk about your career trajectory?
Greetings, everyone. Thank you so very much for inviting me to come into this communal space with you all. I'm an associate professor at Pennsylvania State University, University Park campus. I'm originally from Henning, Tennessee, Alex Haley's hometown, and I always try to stay true to who I am in terms of my roots, pun intended.
Well, thinking about how careers in higher education aren't necessarily one pathway, what are some of the ways that you were motivated to pivot in your career?
So I've pivoted a few times in my career, and I would say those pivots were a blessing. My original plan from high school actually was to become a practicing lawyer. And so in undergrad, I majored in political science. I was active with the pre-law society, but a nice pivot came into my life and really changed. I was exposed to student affairs, residence life specifically. So shout out to the folks who are in student affairs and especially residence life. I learned so much, actually learned a lot from Black women there who gathered me. And once I found out you could work with students, which I really realized I enjoyed, and you could get paid to do that as a career, I put being a lawyer to the side and just really focused on being a student affairs educator. And then another pivot came along, which provided me an opportunity to think about law school again later in life, which I ended up doing. So it's funny because my plan, once I was initially exposed to student affairs, was to become a dean of students. That was just like my focus and my plan. But the creator had different plans for me. And so I ended up being a faculty member, but I still consider myself to be a student affairs educator.
I love that because all of us have our path and trajectory. So it's always nice to hear when folks pivot and why they pivot and affirming that it's okay to pivot because the path is yours to follow.
Absolutely.
So LaWanda, Dr. Ward, in what ways does your work as a former administrator inform now your pedagogy and praxis in the classroom and as a mentor in your faculty role?
So I really try to keep at the forefront students as holistic beings. That was something that I learned as a student affairs educator. And so what I try to do is really try to establish my class environments as communities. And one of my favorite legal scholars, Pauli Murray, is very inspirational to me in thinking about this notion of community where people get to bring their authentic selves into spaces that we're committed to being respectful to one another and learning from one another. And so, you know, of course, student affairs educator, you can't start anything without an icebreaker. So first day of class, you know, make it a point to do an icebreaker so that not just I can get to know the students, but they can get to know me too. And we have conversations about what our community conversations will be, what will guide us. And so I invite them to think about the importance of vulnerability, humility, and accountability. I try to be flexible with assignments. Life is lifing for people and me as well. And so, you know, very early on, trying to stress to the students that I know that you're more than a student, that other things are happening for you. And so let's be in communication with one another. When you need more time for something, you don't have bandwidth for something. I feel like those ways in which I try to push back on that rigid structure of the academy of being the professor is the one who knows and we're pouring into students, that they've come to us as some empty vessel. I push back against that. I believe we're co-creators of knowledge. And again, I view myself as someone who can always learn from students. I've been teaching over 10 years, but student affairs taught me we need to do more listening than talking. And so those are practices that I try to bring into the classroom with me. Those are the jewels that I learned from my student affairs days.
And life has been lifing. and I nervous laughter. Given the very public concerns that Black women have recently had to face and process and mourn, what ways do you encourage Black women to hold and make meaning of their existence in the academy, considering all that's going on around us?
Yes. In this moment, I call it a moment, but it's really our entire existence. Black women, you know, very early on, we're socialized to be loyal and long-suffering. And those two characteristics, they don't serve us well. They serve others well, but they don't serve us well. And so my invitation to other Black women is something I try to practice myself, is that, you know, we untangle from our commitments to these institutions of higher education that were never, ever, and won't be for us. Our labor and all that we can offer, all that can be extracted from us, will always be welcomed. But who we are, our wellness, our personhood will not be affirmed in these places. I recently read Rest is Resistance by Trisha Hersey. I also have it on audio. I have it so literally when I'm driving to the gym, I listen to it, just different parts of the book. I listen. I just love the way that she is connected to, for us, that grind culture, which the academy is, you know, one of the biggest contributors of that. You know, it's all rooted in capitalism and white supremacy. And literally, to save ourselves as Black women, we need to be intentional about untangling ourselves from grinding, doing. My hope and my prayer is that we start to prioritize ourselves more. And I know, you know, some of us, we've said that, including myself, but I really feel like more than a few alarms have gone off for us to pay attention to. And my plea is that Black women prioritize themselves, love themselves, and be in community with others who love us for truly who we are, not what we can do.
Well, and Dr. Kroom and Lori Patton Davis actually wrote that article about Black women being miners, canaries, right? And
yes,
thinking about more public acknowledgement of that in this point. I think more recently, Lori even wrote an op-ed around how Claudine's decision to resign saved her life. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, like, are we able to engage in the academy and not completely withdraw in order to save ourselves? Or does it mean that we do have to fully withdraw in order to be whole as people?
I love that you brought up that tension, because I do see that as a tension. You know, in the U.S. context, the way that we have a livelihood is to work and to be able to provide for our families. Again, you know, thinking about Rest is Resistance, Hersey talks about there's a difference between work and grinding. And I think that Black women, we're grinders. You know, we get hired to clean up, we get hired to transform. And so what would it mean for us to literally look around and say, here are the things that I enjoy about what I do? in my work in higher education. And everything else, I'm going to be strategic about either not doing it or giving it the bare minimum. So I think each one of us, we have to decide what is feasible and reasonable for us to do as a way to resist and push back. But I do think we can do something. I do. Because again, you know, Black women, oh, you know, so-and-so is excellent. She does great work. She's a model. Again, it's that long-suffering narrative that's around us. And again, my hope is that we do an assessment. We say, what can I do that gets this job done, but doesn't compromise my physical being, my mental, my spiritual, my psychological? And I think we can do that. I really do believe it.
But one of what I appreciate is what you're saying, people might have heard before, but somebody's listening and needed a reminder. There's a Black woman needed listening that needs the reminder and the affirmation. So what I appreciate you doing is offering the centering of self, because nobody is going to center you better than you can. And this year at ASH, the gift for those newly tenured was the rest deck, which reclaiming your right to rest from the book. And there's every card is a quote from the book as a reminder. So thank you for amplifying those key points. As we transition here and thinking about work versus grinding, what Black women are offering the Academy and what the Academy is draining Black women of, have you thought about what legacy you want to leave when you think about the work that you've contributed and done, but also the being that you are, the mentoring that you've done, the students that you've helped guide?
I have. So most recently, I have become a great aunt, and that's really put some things in perspective to me, and actually makes me a little emotional, because I'm hopeful that the work that I do will provide an opportunity with that when my great nieces, if they choose to pursue post-secondary education, that wherever they go, the conditions will be better for them than they are right now. And so the work that I do, which, you know, is at the intersection of U.S. higher education and law, is really pushing for the interpretations of law to be dignity affirming for people, because right now they're not. And so while I'm one of the few that's doing that, that's my commitment. And when I think about my great nieces, that's what's really motivating me to say, I won't be here to see when they go to college, but perhaps the work that I do and that others are doing with me, those of us committed to really pushing for, especially in the legal context, interpretations that can be dignity affirming. I would like to be known for being someone who did that, who was a part of that movement.
Well, I hope you're able to achieve those facets quickly, actually, because my daughter's about to go to college. But like, I think thinking about a utopia for women of color, Black women on college campuses, that's amazing. That's amazing. Something else that we prefer to center on our podcast is community building and just getting to know our community members. And so instead of two truths and a lie, we're doing three truths and a dream. So three things that you think would be interesting for folks to know about you that they don't already know that you're comfortable sharing. And then yes, a dream, something that you haven't had a chance to explore yet, but you're curious about.
Yes. So people probably don't know these things about me, especially in the Academy. Now, those who I grew up with, some of them know these things about me. But I was a basketball cheerleader in high school. So I grew up in a family of athletes, and so being a cheerleader, of course, wasn't considered to be an athlete to them. But yeah, I did that. And I'm an avid lover of collegiate basketball. I think as a result of that, specifically the South Carolina women Gamecocks, shout out to Dawn Staley, the GOAT, who I try not to miss a game. Let's see, that's my first one. My second one, I'm a pretty decent dancer. Actually, in high school, I was in an all women's group, and we won a few talent shows in high school. So somewhere there's some footage of me doing like a solo dance that actually helped us to win the talent show. So I'm a pretty decent dancer. The third would be, so I am 51. I'll be 52 this year. And I was never an athlete, but once I turned 40, I really got on this kick of running. And so I've ran over 20 half marathons, including the US, and I also ran in Bermuda. So people might be surprised to learn that about me. And then my dream is to write a book, and not an academic book, to Well, let me move back. The book would be inspired around traveling around the world. And then I just love to write a book about a Black woman character and her experiences with experiencing like global travel. Now, of course, as an academic, I would say that is a dream because, you know, we mainly do peer reviewed work. But I do dream of doing that. And I'm actually putting that out there into the universe. So hopefully someone might hold me accountable and I really get around to doing it. Maybe the two of you will circle back to me to see where I am since we're in community now.
I love it. I love it. I love it. Well, LaWanda, thank you for dropping the gems, sharing your brilliance, and for your energy that you put out. I know it takes a lot. It's draining to put that much love and energy into the world. And what I offer to you and pray for you that it is returned tenfold. So thank you. Stay strong in Pennsylvania. Stay warm in Pennsylvania.
Thank you all so much. I'm honored to be in the community as part of the Scholars Tea now. So thank you both for all that you do. May your lights continue to shine bright. Thank you, and peace and love to everyone who listens to this awesome podcast.
Dr. Ward, it's the legal brilliance for me, right? It's the pairing your two passions, the law and higher education, and really trying to figure out how do we do this work, put it out there, make people comprehend and digest it. So I actually would love to take a law class from somebody like Dr. Ward. I remember my law class in my master's program. It was from the general counsel. I love this man because he eventually became the VP of Student Affairs, which I just thought was so bizarre, but also makes sense from an institution that's trying to protect itself from being sued left and right. But shout out to Dr. Ward and the gems that she dropped.
So we're going to try something different. We're adding a new component to Scholar T. We're going to digest the random question of the week. And so this random question of the week, Cameron, is what is the most common thing that occurs on video chats that others find annoying, which you find hilarious?
I find it hilarious when you can tell people are not paying attention and then it's their turn to either say something or do something. I get tickled by the fluster. So I don't know, that tickles me when I see people flustered. And then I tickle myself because I also get caught doing it. Like, okay, I'm gonna respond to this email while we're on line 3 of the agenda. And they're like, oh, Cameron, what do you think? And I'm like, okay, where are we at? What was said, you know? But I'm always tickled to watch other people. And some people are really good at it and recover. That recovery be quick. And some people will be struggling and I'd be tickled.
I love to watch you recover. My favorite thing, I think it's never going to get old to me. And you know, I'm a cheese ball in this way. But whenever someone has to be like, you're on mute, like it never fails. You think after 4 years of doing this now that we would have at least mastered the unmute button, but no. It is hilarious to me every single time.
And you people with PCs, all you got to hit is the space bar. We don't have that luxury. I'd be like,
wait, what? Let me try it. What?
Life hack, Shauna. Life hack.
Cameron. Mute it. Unmute it. Boom. Ah, yeah. Well, yeah. Then I really don't know. For all the people that knew that that's all you had to do, look, I'm beyond that mug.
Well, you can't do that on a Mac, but you can on a PC.
But still, you know that you need to be unmuted to speak. Still. So whenever, and it's like a song now at this point. You're on mute. Maybe we could turn that into a mix. But I think that's hilarious.
Yes. All right. So what's problematic this week? We are back. We are back. We are back. I was trying to think if I've done this before. And if I did, it had to be first season, but I'm bringing it back up because I was reminded of it. Monday or Friday, faculty or staff or cabinet meetings or department meetings are completely inappropriate and they should be fined. Let the people be and leave us alone. I do not want to sit in your meeting on a Friday morning staring at you, whether that is in person or on these Zoom boxes, talking about nothing. It just never made sense to me. When I was at Salem State, every faculty meeting was on a Monday morning at 9 o'clock. And people lived all over the Boston area trying to get to Salem, Massachusetts at 9 o'clock in the morning. That just made no sense to me. And now I'm at a place where our meeting's on Wednesday morning. So I just know Wednesdays are like a meeting day for me. And I forget that people be sitting in these meetings on a Friday morning or a Friday afternoon. I would have an excuse every other week. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not about to sit here with you and it's TGIF and we going back and forth about a curriculum review. Like, who wants to do that? I can only imagine the meetings you sit in on a Friday, Shauna, but it's problematic and it needs to end.
You want to add a caveat to that?
Go ahead.
Having meetings the week leading up to a break.
Oh, mm-hmm. So spring break. I just looked at that and I was like, why is this meeting on my calendar the Friday before spring break? Like, why are we doing this?
That one, I, you know, knowing what happens on campus and all the problems we have to solve before everybody goes, or quote unquote in people's minds when everybody goes, that one makes sense to me. But let's say the break starts on a Wednesday and you want to meet on Monday and you know most of the people aren't going to be there. Why are you holding the meeting?
Or the Monday after a break. Leave me alone. Let me transition back to this little raggedy job you didn't give me.
Let's talk about some things that are funny.
You got some jokes?
I'm going to switch it up today and give some people some knowledge, you know, some well-earned knowledge, ways to frame some emails when you're feeling some kind of way. So for example, you want to say, fuck you. You can end your email instead with kind regards. Stop wasting my time and just let it go already. You can go with the phrase, moving forward. I'm going to keep sending you emails about this until you respond. Oh, just checking in. You fucked up. Could easily be replaced with, it has been brought to my attention. You can express your opinion, but I give zero fucks. It's more like, I see your point. And finally, if you want to tell people to stop bothering you, try, I hope this helps.
Okay, passive aggressive.
So, you know, I find them hilarious and hopefully, you know, they keep somebody employed next week.
Love it. Well, our affirmation today is for, we're going to see you next time with the jump off. And until we do, peace, love, and